the customary Bon Radio greeting is temporarily undergoing semantic enhancement and will not be extended on today's show. The phrase was recently deemed linguistically frivolous by a panel of vernacular scholars, so Calvos and Damien have ordered it back to the etymological drawing board for dialectic retrofitting. We hope to have a new, improved version in operation by next week. In the meantime, Modovincis, Modovinceris. Like that?
I like that. It sounded like never mind.
All right. The International Classification of Musical Diseases.
Modovinceris.
Did I say that?
Is that right?
The International Classification of
Modovinceris.
Yes, go ahead.
Just to
Reiterate?
Recap.
To recap.
The International No, please. This is serious radio work here. Thank you. The International Classification of Musical Diseases categorizes pistonitis as, quote, a work with academic roots which favors harmonic craftsmanship to the exclusion of all else, especially humor, end quote. The first... Is that some pistonitis in the background?
It is, yes.
I hear it. The first documented outbreak of pistonitis occurred in 1925 while the easily corruptible lad for whom it was named was studying compositional technique with the famous 20th century gymnastician Nadia Boulanger. Piston surprised his teacher on her 38th birthday with a choral fugue in which he spelled the name Nadia in 11 different modes. Unfortunately, the tune contained one four-note phrase of parallel fifths, a device anathema to the exacting educator. Angrily, she ripped the composition to shreds, grabbed the startled lad's head in a vice-like grip, thereafter known as Le Flambeau Orange, and squeezed until warm bodily fluids oozed from his nose and ears. Thereafter known as Le Flambeau Orange.
Le Flambeau Orange.
I heard it come there sometime. Afterwards, the contrite composer was never again to stretch the limits of classic contrapuntal good taste. Pretty evident there, I'd say. Was that a dissonance I heard there?
Never a dissonance.
Another musical disease, nonomenia, derives from the late burly Russian composer Alexander Cherepnin's experiments with a nine-tone scale. Cherepnin previously had attempted to extend the good taste boundaries of 12-tone serialism, but concluded that he simply had three notes too many to work with. Further empirical studies led him to the notion of a nine-tone scale, a concept that was widely rejected when it was learned that Cherepnin's nine tones were all the same tone. The disease can currently be heard running rampant in works by Philip Glass.
I think I can't say anything.
The final disease to be discussed today on Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquihour Expansive. Are you paying attention or just falling?
I'm always paying attention.
Of course.
The single tones were sort of slipping over them. They were ice-like.
They were that.
Ice cream
frosty.
Tones. I don't know.
Gelid. Gelatinous.
Frosty the Tone Man. I don't know. What were you saying?
The final disease to be discussed today is duparcosis, or the urge to destroy compositions of an embarrassing nature. And that's still extant. That hasn't been destroyed yet. Henri Duparc, born 148 years ago tomorrow, and unwilling to appear on today's program, studied music theory with a famous French composer who, if I mentioned his name, you'd recognize in an instant. One day in 1887, Duparc was lobbing sand crabs at unsuspecting tourists on the French Riviera when one of the crabs turned around and bit him. and he experienced a kind of arthropodic epiphany. Immediately, he destroyed all of his extant compositions and moved to Paris, where he gave birth to Nadia Boulanger. The disease has been impossible to eradicate and appears most often in composers who, at one time or another in their careers, sold out. And I don't mean to a standing room audience. That's a caller. Do we dare answer it at this point? Anyway, tune in again for further adventures in the international classification of musical diseases on Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquihour, this portion of which is brought to you in a molecularly homogenized pre-listened format, so you need not pay close attention, as someone has already done it for you. You're welcome. The music in the background is a birthday medley tribute to famous composers Janis Joplin, Maxwell L. Roach, Dolly Parton, Leadbelly Ledbetter, the reconstructed Henri Duparc, as well as the theme Carl Flying Walenda was said to be screaming during his final 10-story descent into a San Juan, Puerto Rico concrete abutment. Cue the cassette. Timing here is of the essence. Yes, are we on top of things? And now, if there are no further questions, let us post haste descend a bit more to the incontrovertibly aleatoric realm of Calvo.
Aleatoric indeed. I have been aleatorizing as you've been speaking, most of which having to do with my inability to stay properly balanced.
You have a
on
new
my two-tone scale, which involves boots of some sort.
Those boots are made for trucking.
They're made for something. Anyway, in the background is Walter Piston, in case you had not yet guessed, three New England sketches, the Maestoso Mountains. Let's just listen for a while because I gotta go get my balance. Well, do you think that's enough of Mr. Piston
it's
for
never,
a while?
It's never enough, but...
I'm getting a very bad case of pistonitis that did not help my balance at all.
That could be Duparca. What was the other one? Duparcaectomy?
Duparcaectomy. I don't know. Let's have a pistonectomy. I think we can do that. We got a quiz right off before we bring in our guest today.
Oh, early guest.
Yes, early guest today.
Does that mean they're leaving early, too?
How did you guess? A guest.
Guess?
Yes. Here's the quiz. It's a real short one. 454-7762, and we'll
Glipsob,
give you Glipsob, 10802 Glipsob, and it's very brief, and it has to do with today's special events, and here it is. This is all of it. Call us if you know what this is. That's it. 454-7762.
That's it, was it?
That's it.
Could we have a reprise of that?
Oh, sure, anytime.
454-7762.
It's... And that's all you get. We'll get that back to that quiz later if you don't know. But there's a caller. Maybe it is a winner.
Do you want just? There, well, let's put this person on the air.
WGDR.
Are we professional or not?
Oh, he's gone.
Oh, this is sorry.
It's not
this
a real call.
It's not a real call. It's an artificial call.
A while.
I should point out to our other part of the Calvos and Damian New Music Sesqua Hour that an occasional listener pointed out to me last night that although we say there is a quiz and there may or may not be a winner, we occasionally forget to say what a person may win or, in fact, divulge the answer.
Ah.
We have gone weeks, in fact, without proper quiz-answer relationship.
Well, didn't we give the answer to the last week's quiz?
We did, but that was back in February when we did it.
True enough. Oh, well, listen. We will give you the answer to this week's quiz at the end of the show because this is not a write-in. This is a call-in, 454-7762. You have to call us with the answer to that. And your prize will be a copy of the remarkable science fiction novel, The Carmora Papers, we have 330 copies
to
give away.
I'd like to sweeten the pot here. I think that there are some people who may be literally challenged. So there it is again. And I'd like to sweeten the pot with a brand new, unused, hermetically sealed whoopee cushion.
Oh, unsealed whoopee cushion. That means it still has the talcum powder.
All the talcum powder is in it, and
wonderful.
Not a single whoop has been emitted from this
particular cushion. A fresh whoopee cushion and a copy of the Carmora Papers.
Yeah,
so you can identify what that was.
Sorry, you can't get away from the Carmora Papers.
You have
once
to,
more.
You have to accept a copy. Oops, that's the wrong one. That's Walter Piston.
They sort of go together. Are those final chords or what?
Those were final-ish chords. 454-7762, that's your last chance for the moment, because we have a guest today. We have an extraordinary composer who's with us. Joel Chatterby has come from the far reaches of another state.
No kidding.
Yes. Another state of mind. Another state of being. But nevertheless, he is here.
Let's swing the Sesqua microphones over to that.
That's right.
Matt.
That's right. Joel Chatterby, he is here with us today. And
well, he could make a little effort and get a little closer to the machine, too.
Well. Oh. Hello. Hi.
How are you?
Hey. Joel, okay. You're going to introduce something we're going to play. But first of all, who the heck are you?
Who am I? Well, I sometimes wonder myself. But today, at least, I'm certainly here as a composer of After Some Songs.
Yes, that's a CD, which we've played excerpts from in the previous month and a half in expectation that you would have been with us 2 weeks ago, which you were not, so we got to play your stuff too much.
The best plans.
Yeah, we played too much of it already.
Okay, did you play Corcovado, My Funny Valentine?
Oh, we did?
I don't know.
Would you like to hear Corcovado now, or would you like to hear Valentine or Money? Which one would you like to hear?
Well, what do you think? Would you like me to talk a little bit about how those were made?
Let's hear, and then we'll put the pieces together.
Great. Let's do it.
No, let's hear from you.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Let's start this again. Our guest today is Joel Chatterjee. He's going to tell us about some compositions he's done.
Listen, I grew up with jazz classics, and I just got to love all of those things a lot. And then I started experimenting with electronics and various other things and got away from them for about 20 years. And about 1984, 1985, I kind of got the idea to, you know, I'd been having dreams about them. I'd been singing the songs. I'd been picking them out on the piano again, and I sort of thought that I had to do something. So I went down to New York to 48th Street and bought a fake book.
Ah, fake book, our favorite thing.
Well, at that time, the best fake book was called The Real Book.
The Real Book, yes.
In fact, it's
still in print, isn't it?
It still is. And so I started playing over those songs again. And enjoying it very much, and in fact enjoying it so much that I figured I had to do something with them. And so I started fooling around with them electronically, and in particular with some computer software that did, I wouldn't say variations on them exactly. It's not quite, it's not really a performance of the song, but I sort of think of them as an abstraction of the songs.
Is this a software that you wrote, or did you use someone else's? Or
well, a software that I played a part in designing. Actually, this was one of the first pieces of software that came out of Intelligent Music, which is a company I set up about 1985, 1986.
Intelligent Music, that's almost, never mind.
Like military music, that's an oxymoron, you mean, intelligent music? Would you like to go on? All right. Okay, so you did that, and so what did you learn from the pieces that you went back to, and how did you incorporate them?
Well, you know, I chose a lot of. I found out some pieces live longer than others. Some pieces, you know, one finds more interesting than others with repeated listening. But in any case, they kind of hovered in the background as I used them to create new kinds of textures and new kinds of melodic ideas. And so I thought it might be kind of interesting today to play some of the original or some real performed versions of the songs and then to see how the software and how I kind of mess them up to create these new textures.
Great. Well, we've got two original songs. Would you like to play, Valentine is relatively short. We could play that, play the a copy of My Funny Valentine, and then we could play it again.
Let's do that. I think that would be a great idea.
Okay, great. All right. We're going to hear by Joel Chatterjee. We're going to hear Valentine after My Funny Valentine, composition for vibraphone, marimba, and electronics with Jen Williams on the percussion. Thank you. Valentine after My Funny Valentine by Joel Chadaby. We got some original material set up there, and you're going to, lead us into what we're supposed to figure out from listening to that?
Well, I just thought I'd make a few remarks about the way the piece was originally done. You know, I've been working with Jan Williams, who's the percussionist, on that cut for about 20 years.
Ah.
And long, long ago, Jan and I started to play around with different kinds of improvisations with percussion and electronics. And in this particular case, there were a lot of things came into play by 1985. For one thing, I was getting older and weaker and a little tired of carrying around a big synclavier.
So they were big in those early days.
So we changed around to a Macintosh, and this new software was written for a Macintosh. And I had actually kind of hoped that I would only have to carry a disc to these concerts, then that I could find a Macintosh in place and the synthesizers in place. So that was done with one of the first of the Yamaha synthesizers.
Okay, yeah, right.
And the idea was to make a percussion recital for Jan, so that I was not going to be on stage actually performing, but that I would kind of create this sort of variation that would act as a sort of interactive score that would give Jan some basis from which to improvise.
In other words, you put the thing together, and then what does it do? Is it different each time?
It is different. It tends to be somewhat the same when we play it often, and then when we don't play it for 3 or 4 months, it's different, and we have to start all over again and putting it together and working it out.
I guess I meant the electronic part. Is that...
That's what I mean.
Okay. All right.
In other words, the electronic part is very flexible, and it can be done in a lot of different ways. And so it's a question of we follow each other in performance, but we generally like to know pretty much which way it's going to go before we walk out there on stage, or before Jan walks out there.
It sounds like the software is mutating and it's on its diskette while you're away from it. What do you mean that that you have to get...
There are a lot of controls that you can restructure things. You can do all kinds of different things while the...
Such as what?
While the program runs. You can change patterns. You can change the order of little fragments coming in. You can change the notes, change the transpositions. You can do all kinds of different things to it.
So when you say it's based on My Funny Valentine, what is it based on? The chordal structure, the way the melody falls?
Yes, I played My Funny Valentine into the computer.
Okay.
And then to get the basic kinds of patterns, I used the program's different kinds of variables to play with it. So changing accent patterns, changing transpositions, changing the ordering of the notes, doing things of that sort.
Okay.
But the sounds that I made were all intended to be like percussion sounds. In other words, I wanted specifically that a public hearing Jan playing this would not be able to know which of the sounds were played by the percussion and which were played by the electronics.
Right, okay.
Because I wanted to kind of expand the idea. So if Jan's playing a vibraphone, you hear three times as many notes as a vibraphone can play. And sometimes, in fact, Jan used to say, that I play a note and I'm not sure where it's coming from.
I guess feedback for the performer can be pretty disturbing sometimes if you're expecting to hear your own action and you're not quite sure.
Sure. But disturbing, I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun. I think that that he seems to have enjoyed it a lot.
Well, let's listen to an original of this and follow it up again with Valentine.
Great.
And see if we can perceive. Give us a hand. Before we listen to it, we're going to hear Tony Bennett's version of it, but give us a hand. What is it that comes out of that we should be able to hear as the substructure or the patterning that you have in your piece?
Well, what I hear very clearly are the chords and the melody.
Okay. All right. Let's listen for this. This is great. This is great. Listening for the chords and the melody of a piece of such a... I don't know, almost a standard of such cloying characters sometimes and resolved into a very different piece, very percussive piece. Here we go.
Okay.
Tony Bennett singing My Funny Valentine.
You're my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little when you open it to speak? Are you smart? But don't change a hair for me. Not if you care for me. Say, Valentine's Day.
Valentine by Joel Chadaby. Jan Williams on the percussion and Joel on the electronics, preceded by the Tony Bennett, Yes, I'm on Pitch Today version of My Funny Valentine. And you were very excited at the conclusion of the Tony Bennett version and the beginning of yours because they were in the same key.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now we've heard it. Now what do we hear? Let me just interrupt and say, now what do we hear on the Calvos and Damian New Music Sesquihour on WGDR Plainfield?
Sorry.
And you're back on. That was our required station ID. Thank you. Not yet downsized government.
I see. Okay. right.
This short naps.
Well, you know, this approach went on to a lot of different songs. And actually, I found it a wonderfully interesting way to deal with this whole kind of literature, that is in sort of recreating the whole thing. I think that a lot of these songs, you know, we understand some things in life because we like some things in life because we don't quite understand them, and so we keep coming back to them to try and understand them a little bit better.
We like mystery.
We like mystery, and definitely.
Okay. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Forms that you don't quite get, that aren't completely coherent. In other words, there's always something new. There's always something that keeps you trying to get it. On the other hand, we also like certain kinds of things because we understand them so completely that we find them really very relaxing.
Okay.
I was very impressed, you know, by Milton Babbitt. Milton Babbitt's knowledge of 1920s songs.
Now, Milton Babbitt is I always refer to him sort of as the used car salesman of new music because he will, once started, not wind down for a long time if you ask him a question. And he writes some very angular kinds of pieces based on mathematical concepts and so forth, and would not be thought of as one who would be likely to know We're in the Money or a tune like that as part of his repertoire.
Absolutely, you know, but he does. He does, and it's two sides of the same coin. And in fact, that's the whole idea, you know, that some things we like because they're sort of difficult to understand, and some things we like because they're easy to understand.
Okay.
But I saw Milton. You know, Milton is now in his mid-80s.
Yes, he was up here last year.
Was he?
As a matter of fact, at the Werbrook Contemporary Music Festival,
right.
One of our pianists was performing one of his synchronisms. I think it was Singer. No, that was the other fellow. What was the? Never mind. Anyway,
Mario Davidovsky.
Right. It wasn't Davidovsky. Babbitt was here, and he was playing one of. And he'll give us a call if our local skilled pianist Michael Arnowitt will give us a call and tell us what it was he played of Milton Babbitt's. Anyway, he was here last year. He's charming and absolutely wonderful in person.
Yes, he was, and I had a wonderful talk with Milton about a year ago in New York, where he spent the first 20 minutes of our talk complaining about not being able to find a good corned beef sandwich in New York anymore. And then we started to talk about some 1920 songs, and I said, Milton, do you happen to know Ba-dee-da-b? And he said, but not for me.
he
knows the songs.
He knows
very,
the songs.
Very, very well indeed. But they represent two completely different sides of things. I forgot who it was, Henry Pleasance, who years ago wrote a book called The Agony of Modern Music, where he criticized contemporary composers for going out to jazz joints after they came from their contemporary music concerts.
Really?
Or so he put it. I mean,
okay.
he used all of this as an example to discredit contemporary music, as if all of this music was so cacophonous that no one could possibly enjoy it, and that the composers really liked the kind of music that everyone else liked, which are these kind of jazz standards. And I just have thought back on that. I mean, I thought it was ridiculous at the time because, you know, sometimes you enjoy jazz. I mean, I've always kind of liked it. I think that the kinds of things that I remain interested in are not the simpler standards, but rather, you know, food, to mix metaphors, with a little more spice in it.
food. He's brought up the important food issue. Yes, the great component of our show. We must think of food. Yeah, go ahead.
But the point is that you don't read James Joyce with your morning coffee. That you can also take a look at Doonesbury. That some things you really like because they're fun and because they're very light and because you do understand them. And other things you like because they're really interesting and because you want to come back
again and again because you never quite get it. And that's what's so appealing about them. So what I tried to do with these songs was to take things that I grew up with, that was sort of in my blood, on the one hand, but that on the other hand I found a little bit boring, and I thought that I'd make them a little bit more interesting. You know, I found going through that fake book, for example, is a terrific pleasure. I love to sit down at the piano and play all of those songs, but after about 20 minutes, I do begin to get bored. And so I thought I'd make them live a little bit more interestingly for me by, so to speak, abstracting them. You know, I don't think of these as jazz performances. I think of them as abstractions of the jazz classics. Although in some cases you can't tell what the songs are.
All right, but in many cases the jazz performances are abstractions of existing tunes.
It's true also, yes.
Yeah. I want to get back to those questions. Let's listen to something else of yours, and I want to get back to the question of what the audience has to bring to the music to let it live inside them. So let's listen to something else and then come back to it. What do you think we should hear?
Well, about? I think, why don't we listen to, is it called Corcovado there? It's called Echoes
of Brazil. Echoes
of Brazil,
yes.
Right.
Okay, we'll listen to Echoes of... Should we listen to Corcovado first?
Let's listen to Corcovado first.
All right.
Actually, and then Echoes of Brazil.
All right. This is a recording of Corcovado with João Gilberto, and it will make it go right... After about 2 minutes, we'll make it join right into Joel Chatterby's Echoes of Brazil. So first, João Gilberto with Corcovado, followed by Echoes of Brazil by Joel Chatterby.
Este amor, uma canção, pra fazer feliz a quem se ama. Muita calma pra pensar e ter tempo pra sonhar. Da janela vence o Corcovado, o Redentor, que lindo. Quero a vida sempre assim, com você perto de mim, até o apagar da velha chama. E eu que era triste, descrente desse mundo, ao encontrar você eu conheci o que é felicidade, meu amor.
Echoes of Brazil by Joel Chatterby, and that was preceded by Antonio Carlos Jobim's piece, Corcovado, is done by João Gilberto. Well, that was another one where we're following up the original with yours, made very clear how that relationship was.
Yeah, basically what I did is to play Corcovado into the computer, and then I played around with the patterns, accent patterns in particular, and so on, note orders, transposition. No, it's short, you know, everything you can think of doing, everything player would normally improvise.
You know, and but this piece is so, dare I say, listenable, and yet you proceed. You just said that you talked about chord patterns and all of those things. You talked about technical issues on a piece that is that comes forth in a very musical way. I, as a listener, I don't have a clue that you're talking about software and analysis.
I know. See, I find that's what I find the most. And not only that, you know, in this last piece, Bruno Sperry is playing. I mean, he's improvising. We're improvising together,
right?
With the computer.
Now you improvise with the computer. How you sort of you have?
I'll playing the patterns in different ways, and you know, there are.
What do you do you physically do? Do you sit in front of the keyboard?
I'm sitting there with a mouse.
With a mouse, okay.
I'm sitting there with a mouse.
And the mouse does what? You pull software levers or something?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm moving software sliders.
Okay.
I'm clicking software buttons.
Okay.
I'm turning software knobs. I'm doing.
And they're labeled things like what? Change pattern here or what? How would I look? How would I see that?
I forget exactly what they're named. I remember the graphic shapes more than I remember the words that are next to the graphic shapes. But they're things like a pattern permutation, accent patterns.
Okay.
There's a grid, for example, where I can click on different parts of the grid to decide how many, where the beats come and whether the beats are strong or weak.
Okay. So when you sit there in performance, you... In a piece, in this particular rendition of this, do you recall what you did?
In this particular, I was mostly, by the time it got to doing this with Bruno, I was bringing in different voices at different times.
Okay. All right.
So I'd worked this out a little bit with him beforehand.
Okay.
So in this particular performance, which is not to say in every performance, I mean, it just so happens that in this case, we knew pretty much what we were going to do before we sat down and did it. But it's a sense of where it's worked out, we work it out, and then we just try and do it pretty much the same way.
Well,
the idea is you never walk out on stage without knowing roughly what it is that you're going to do. But you know, one of the things that I've taken really a great deal of satisfaction in from this disc is that there's a lot of technology in this.
Okay.
It's not obvious technology. It's levels of technology. There's Macintosh technology. There's Macintosh.
You don't want your listener to actually hear technology.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's what I get the most satisfaction from. It's that it's all absolutely invisible. That it's just, I mean, I think of that as being really high tech. When the technology is completely invisible, when it is so human that you can actually improvise with it. That's, I think, a measure of its quality, and I personally take a great deal of satisfaction from this disc in that sense.
Well, let's talk about that, because I have an email in front of me from one of our listeners, and one of the things this listener asks is wondering about the relationship between a composer and a performer, asking questions like, how does the performer... how legitimate are performers playing composers in expressing and conveying what's intended? Is a performer an invisible middleman? What's the true meaning? Is it resting solely in the notes? How valid is interpretation? And in a piece like yours, you are also a performer in a sense, performing on the computer that's making the permutations. How is this relationship developed? Here you have this wonderful percussionist, Jen Williams, this wonderful sax player, Bruno Sperry. How do these performers understand in both their minds and in their instruments and in their musical sense what the heck is going on in a, quote, performance, end quote, or a recording session that involves something that does not appear to be an instrument?
Well, first of all, you know, I would say that it doesn't work with every performer. That generic performer does not really exist, that there are all kinds of different approaches to the situation. I've played a lot with Jan, but even at the beginning, you know, he just understood what I was doing, and I just understood his processes of performance so that it clicked. And that's why we've worked together so well over the years. When we're doing an improvisation together, I know what Jan's going to do before he knows what he's
okay,
going to do.
So this isn't a mechanistic thing at all?
No, it's not at
okay.
all mechanistic.
Uh-huh.
The same is true with Bruno. I've played a lot of concerts with Bruno in Europe. And there's another percussionist on the disc, which, you know, we'll play a little. He's a little bit in the background, Rado Weber. But we've all played together, and it just works so easily that we just right away know how to work together. And when you find performers like that, especially in an improvisational situation, you know, you tend to cultivate that relationship and work with them all the time, because it really just clicks. But normally, when you use the word performer, you think of a performer playing a composer's music.
Yeah, that's
so in that kind
very
of
often what we do on the show is listen to that sort of recordings. How is this different?
Well, the idea there, you know, is that music has been performed before the music has been composed before it's been performed. And this does work really different. It works really differently because what I did as a composer is not to compose the music. The music could come out in lots of different ways. What I did is to compose the system that composes the music. And I choose the sounds. So it's the sounds and the system. And what I mean by the system is that I choose sort of different ways that I can make things happen is probably the best way to say it.
Okay.
And I choose what the sounds are that I'm going to work with. And then the music really comes together. I'm composing with Jan, with Bruno, with Rado, when we're in performance. So that's when the real, first it's like composing the system, then it's like composing while we're performing. And it is certainly very improvisational. It's not like old-fashioned improvisation. I mean, it's, you know, but it's a different kind of improvisation.
Could you create the software in such a way that you could push a Charlie Parker button?
I know, nor would I want to. I mean,
no, I know you wouldn't want to.
There have been a lot of experiments with imitating known styles of jazz or imitating known styles of music. I mean, David Cope, you know, the West Coast composer at Santa Cruz, has programs that imitate Rachmaninoff and so on. I have no interest academically or in any other way.
But if someone is to imitate Joel Chadaby, is there some way in which you've chosen your system and the choices that you've made throughout the process of performing this live that makes it clearly yours?
Well, I'm always there. See, the whole point when I make these systems isn't that they're imitating any style. It's that they're putting me into a position as a composer. As a metaphor, I give you this. You know, some contemporary planes like the Airbus 320 cannot be flown manually because there are too many control surfaces. So pilots use what they call a fly-by-wire system. Now, in a fly-by-wire system, the pilot is really operating the controls to tell a computer what the pilot wants to do. And the computer is then flying the plane. So
nice you chose the Airbus, which the computer did not quite work that out a few years ago correctly.
I know. Well,
trees.
In fact, I talked to some pilots about that, and I had a kind of long, interesting talk with a United Airlines pilot who was very articulate on the subject of fly-by-wire systems. And his point had a lot to do with mistakes coming from lack of feedback, and he mentioned some very interesting things, which probably is not within the range of our conversation today about the way cockpits are designed. But my point here is that I view these musical systems a little bit as sort of flying a plane through a musical space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I set up the computer to give me controls of all of the musical variables so that they're very intuitive and so that I can do whatever I want to do. But whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it, I can do it with whatever controls I have available, and I can manipulate a lot of different musical things.
What I'm asking is there some way in which you do this manipulation and in which you fly the music by wire, so to speak, that is clearly yours? Is there a way that...
It's my style. It's only me.
So I can, you know, in 10 years, put on this and I will understand it, even if I had never heard this, but know something, I will be able to say, that's the Joel Chadaby style.
I would certainly hope so.
Okay.
I would certainly hope so. I mean, this is me at the music. My whole point about technology is that the issue here is not that I'm trying to remove the human being. I'm trying to make the human being more powerful, more responsive, more sensitive, to put a human being in a more interesting kind of environment.
So what? No, that's not. Sorry, that's not.
That's what happens when you hand the microphone off.
Right. Play something else. Let's play this Africa tune.
Well, yeah, you know, I think Africa is not based on anything. Africa is really just an improvisation. And not only that, but on this particular disc, it has all four of us playing. So there is myself, there's Bruno Sperry, there's Jan Williams, and there's Rado Weber, who is playing, in this case, udu drum.
Oh, well, fine, then.
And this, and as just as another thing, this particular piece, Africa, was written in Bruno Sperry's studio in Zurich, just before a concert we did there. So, it, you know, I wrote, did it in a couple of hours, and then we went out and performed it together for the first time.
That's it. Just flash before us all these lovely little areas in Europe where you perform, and we're here stuck in the snow and the flood of central Vermont. But don't let, it's not getting us down, certainly not. So we'll just hear something that was thought about in Europe where they have coffee every morning.
The name here comes actually from a friend, an African musician who lived in Zurich at the time.
Zurich, get that. This is not Zurich, Iowa. This is Zurich.
This is Zurich, Switzerland.
Right.
And so we used one of, to start in the first version of the piece using some of Bruno's equipment, we used one of his percussion sounds. That's not in this particular version. But Bruno had, we performed it for the first time.
Okay, Bruno Walter's studio. Bruno...
Bruno Sperry.
That's right. Sperry, Rand, Lenz, play the thing.
Thank you.
A Touch of Africa by Joel Chatterby. A piece that triggered a discussion off mic about music and where it comes from out of the composer. I had been harassed for a number of years by a young lady who was not pleased by the notion that it was possible to use technologies to produce music. She wanted the music to come from the heart, as she phrased it. How do you think of what it is you do? As you're sitting in front of a computer console, do you perform from the heart, as it were?
Oh, you know, the whole point of technology, as far as I'm concerned, is to facilitate, is to make a seamless connection in between any kind of a musical idea or a musical impulse or emotional impulse you have. Music, a lot of it is in one way or another cathartic, and it should just come out very, very easily, and technology should be effortless. But what's different, you know, we always use technology. Anyway, there are some very primitive instruments,
all right.
You know, maybe that aren't. But instruments, musical instruments, are artifacts, and they always represent their times and places. In ancient Australia, for example, the Aboriginals took hollowed-out logs. That is, they took a log, and they hollowed it out with termite cultures, baked it in mud and so on, then painted it when it was used ceremonially. And it was called a didgeridoo, so basically it's a hollowed-out log, and it's so it has such a large embouchure. It's one of the simplest musical instruments there is.
And it produces a grand, wonderful, resonant
sound. When it's good. There are good ones and bad ones. Yes. I mean, good didgeridoos are fabulous. But you can only get, you know, the second and third harmonics because of the way the instrument is just too large to get the fundamental. You can't.
It's too low to be heard.
No, you just can't get your lips to vibrate.
Ah, your lips won't.
And you can't get the tension you need to get the higher tone. So basically, you have two notes. And working out circular breathing, it becomes a kind of drone-like, pulse-like sort of instrument. Now, it might occur to someone that's trying to make music that such a primitive instrument, for example, might be better developed so that you could do a little bit more musically with it, so that you could extend your voice a little bit more.
All right.
In other words, with an instrument, what you're always trying to do is to extend your body. Technology extends human beings. So if from this person's point of view, if you want to get real primitive, well, you could say, I mean, you could give up instruments altogether, I say.
And only sing.
And only sing.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But on the other hand, if you're making an instrument, you could say, well, here's an instrument that's so low-tech that it comes right from the heart, but you can only play two notes with it. And then you might decide, well, you know, we'd like to play three notes or maybe 20 notes. And so you might even start thinking, now, should it be in wood? And so you look around and see what your available materials are, and you build up more and more powerful instruments that just extend you in more satisfying kinds of ways.
All right.
Now, violin has no moving parts. It essentially has no real subsystems. It is 18th century, 17th century, pre-industrial age European technology. A piano, however, which we now think of as certainly a very expressive instrument, is a machine. It's a wooden machine. But boy, I'll tell you, to see a piano put together, we have a good friend who makes pianos, makes old pianos, and to see all these little subsystems and all the mechanisms, the mechanical engineering that goes into making a piano is formidable.
The lever and how it pushes the striker and how it releases and the various levels of springs and tensions and how the strap and the saddle pull the thing away from the string.
And exactly. And yet it becomes a very expressive instrument. In fact, so expressive that keyboards have been probably the closest that we've achieved to what you might call a universal instrument. It is so universal that even electronic synthesizers are all made with keyboards. And keyboards were developed to throw levers. I mean, they were developed to activate strings in one way or another. There's no need to use a keyboard with electronics. But keyboards remain the basic performance device with electronic instruments because we somehow like them so much. Why do we like them? We like them because they extend our fingers, because they give us fingertip control over a kind of musical process. Drumsticks extend our arms. We want always technology in one way or another, whether it's mechanical technology or whatever, to extend our bodies. But we don't want to have to think about the instrument. If you're using a screwdriver, you don't want to think about the screwdriver. You want to think about the wall you're building or the piece of wood or whatever. You want to think about what you're doing with the tool, not the tool itself. Technology should always be invisible. The instrument you're playing should be invisible.
So at this point, you've had enough experience with your system and your software that, that to you, it is a performance instrument, the technology of which is invisible.
When I'm using it in performance.
Yes.
But there are two stages at which I use the technology.
All right.
I mean, the point is that what I do is to develop a technology that lets me use that to make an instrument. And then I play the instrument. So the first step is...
Is the instrument, in a sense, virtual? Is that what you're saying? That you create an instrument that isn't a physical instrument?
Well, it's a software, yes.
It's a software instrument.
But it has
a
hardware aspect to it. I mean, I'm using a mouse. I'm using other performance devices. At different times, I've performed sometimes with theremins. I've performed with various kinds of devices. You can choose an electronic device according to the way you want to control the music. If you want to wave your hands in the air, for example, you might use a theremin. If you want to hit something, you might use some kind of a stick. If you want to use your fingers, you might choose a keyboard.
And why did you choose this?
Well,
because expression.
You mean why did I choose the way I do after some songs?
Why did you choose that as opposed to a standard keyboard? Or why did you choose that as opposed to taking these in one case, particularly in Valentine, a piece where you yourself said the instrument is often indistinguishable from the performer? Why that choice? Why not three or four performers? Why the choice of the instrument to do the electronic software to do that?
Well, I view it as, in fact, a performance. That is, I don't view myself as replacing anything. I am a performer, and that's just the way I'm working. And the reason I didn't want to use a performance device is because in this particular set, in other cases, I have been there up on stage playing real things that look like instruments. I mean, they might be unusual things.
Right.
But in this particular case, I did not want to be up on stage. I wanted to be able to carry a disc around instead of carrying equipment around. I wanted to, be able to go to Paris, for example, to do a concert and just use my friend's Macintosh and someone else's TX-816 and not have to worry about carrying around equipment. And I wanted to be off stage. That is, I viewed this as a percussion recital for Jan. So he has two speakers on stage with him, and that's all we need. So it was a kind of minimal approach. It's not minimal enough for me, but I viewed it as being very minimal. That is, real high-tech, invisible there, except for two loudspeakers on stage. Very different from the way rock bands used to be. When you had walls of loudspeakers, power, wanted invisibility. I wanted the invisibility of technology. That's what I like. I find, you look at a meadow, and you see absolutely nothing in the meadow except grass and trees. That is high tech. I'll tell you, it's a joke. We talked about Milton Bowers before, but he told me a joke years ago that I think is great. The joke went like this. It said, someone asks you, what is radio? And Milton said, well, to imagine radio, first you've got to imagine telegraph. And to imagine a telegraph, you have to imagine a long dog with its head in the Bronx and its tail in Brooklyn. And then to imagine radio, you take away the dog.
We almost best not pursue that. Let's listen to something else. And there's a few. We're going to run out of time. Gosh, let's listen to another piece, and then we'll talk some more, and then we'll get back and listen to one more after that.
Okay, thank you.
What are we going to hear next?
Well. I keep forgetting.
Well, we have you. We have another approach to rhythm, which we've already played on this program. And many mornings. We were going
to
end with many mornings.
Let's listen to Stella by Starlight.
Stella by Starlight.
That is Elusive Lady, I think.
Yes, that's right. I don't have Stella by Starlight to play with you. We have played Bella by Barlight, which is another composer's variation on that.
I think anyone who knows the song will hear the tune in this particular case. And this is electronics, and there's Jan playing there, and there's also Bruno Sperry playing saxophone.
Okay, by Joel Chatterby, Elusive Lady after Stella by Starlight. Thank you. by Joel Chatterby. That's Elusive Lady. Oops, whoops, that's something else just slid in underneath there. No, we can't hear that yet. We'll hear that later. Elusive Lady after Stella by Starlight. That's a very, very sweet piece.
It is kind of, well, it's Stella by Starlight is a kind of sweet song.
Question about these pieces we've heard. They are very, dare I use the term, listenable.
I find them extremely, extremely listenable.
There's a whole, not even a tradition so much, but a whole experience in this century of a lot of music that is, you might say, not listenable. Now, I'm not sure that that's the right word to use. It's probably music with which people have not had a lot of experience listening because of some sort of chasm that opened up between composers and listeners. But what's the deal here? What is going on that brings you and many other composers into a world of music that is not confrontational in the way it was confrontational for, gosh, half a century?
Well, you know, my music has changed, too, a great deal as I...
And tell me why, since you just say that. We haven't even explored where you came from in musically, so maybe we can have the five-minute précis of whether you did explore some of those other areas and what brought you here.
Well, as I think that, you know, the whole sociology of electronic music has changed a great deal, but then the world has also changed. Technology has changed a great deal. And electronic music is very related to electronic technology in general. I started in 1965 with some Robert Moog equipment. Moog set up shop in 1964.
The original Moog synthesizer.
The original Moog synthesizer, uh-huh. Exactly. But then this was very, very soon after he began, and we cooked up some ideas together about some systems. And I cooked up some ideas about programming that Bob helped me to design during the 60s. But the point, I mean, there are a lot of things that, you know, I recall, for example, that I hadn't known much about technology before that, but it just clicked. It was just,
okay,
for me,
yeah,
a very wonderful,
yeah,
way of working. But part of that was the exploration involved, that it was a kind of adventure. It was new territory, definitely new territory for music. And it was at a time when a lot of people were interested in new kinds of sounds. Percussion, and certainly the whole idea of new sounds was in the air. It was in the air since the beginning of the century. Everyone,
right,
was looking for new kinds of sounds. And in the same way in art, you don't want to see perpetual pictures of sailboats on lakes.
Okay.
So in music, you don't want to,
yeah, yeah,
you know, you're looking for new subject matter and new kinds of sounds, new colors, new textures, all of that. And in electronics, I just found more than sounds. I found a way of working that to me was terrifically exciting. And it was this idea of interactive composing, that you could really compose not by putting pieces of, you know, symbols on paper where you were making some kind of an object, but rather where you could set up a system and compose sort of interactively with that system. Anyway, that was sort of the idea that I developed, and I came to call it interactive composing at the time. But one sense of, see, that was very consistent with the sociology of electronic music in the 60s, which is that it was very different from electronic music. No one would have dreamed of imitating a clarinet in the 1960s.
All right, yes,
I mean,
that's right.
We would have said, hey, go on out and hire a clarinetist if you want a clarinet sound.
And, in fact, the Musicians Union suggested that very strongly.
Yes, indeed. And yeah, for sure. But the sense of it was that electronics were real different than instrumental music, and they should be different. And the logic of that, then, was that electronic sounds should do what instruments cannot do, and what only electronic sounds could do. And consequently, electronic sounds did not sound familiar and friendly. And everyone was exploring new kinds of sounds, and so was I. And there are certain classifications of sounds that, in fact, you can't do with acoustic instruments.
And, right, exactly.
And a lot, yes, of my music was like that, and it was fascinating. I mean, I thought it was really terrific. But it was also true that in the real world, very few people really could relate to that. Most people do not have the time to really get involved intellectually with music, that is, to understand music as ideas, as an interesting kind of language. I would urge that everyone do that, because I think it's one of the most rewarding and interesting art forms there is, but most people don't. So most people tend to like the kinds of music that they're very familiar with. And from a composer's point of view, if you want to reach then a larger audience, you have to work with something that is a little bit more familiar and friendly sounds. And well, by the 70s and by the 80s, consumerism had sort of come into play. But my view of it, I mean, other people have called it consumerism, and it's sort of the word kind of clicked with me, but that's not entirely the way I look at it. The way I look at it is that it was a more holistic view of the world, where composers were beginning to view the audience as part of the musical process. Now, you know,
is that a return to different music, to that kind of musical sensibility, or is it something that had to be developed anew?
So classical aristocratic music was never meant for a wide audience. It was used to be the aristocracy.
Yes.
I mean, the normal people rarely went to those concerts.
So our illusion of the great crowds listening to the magic flute
And the magic flute was a kind of exception, because that was done in a public theater.
Oh, okay, all right.
But that is one of the interesting exceptions. And the Singspiel in Germany, which is the magic flute, I mean, was a kind of medium that was often performed, in fact, in commercial theaters.
Okay.
But but the tradition isn't exactly that. You know.
All right.
But my point is that with this view kind of that the audience was part of a musical process, it went very against, you know, Milton Babbitt. I'm sorry to interrupt myself.
Milton, yes,
yeah,
please.
But coming
yes.
back to Milton. Milton wrote an article in the 1960s, I believe, that was published in High Fidelity magazine. And the name of the article, the title of it, was Who Cares If You Listen?
Yes, I read that. As a matter of fact, I have a copy of that still in my home.
Well, then you know that what Milton was saying is basically that music is of that time had become so complex that one could not expect that the public would support it, and consequently it needed university and foundation support. But it was the editor of High Fidelity magazine that named it Who Cares If You Listen. Milton's original title was something completely different. And it was the editor that wanted the title to be very provocative. And unfortunately, it's haunted Milton really ever since, because, of course, he's always cared about an audience. Naturally, he's
yes.
always cared about an audience.
Yes,
but he's cared about his ideal audience, which is the audience that can understand his music, as all composers that write any kind of music do. But at that time, the idea from a composer's point of view was, you just do your best, and never mind the audience. It was, say whatever you think. Don't care if anyone understands you. Just do your best, right? Just do everything you can do, no matter how complex it is, no matter how absurd it may sound, no matter how ugly it might sound to people that aren't familiar with it. You just, if that's what you believe, do it. So there was a huge element of what I call personal integrity involved during the 60s. And that changed to what a cynical person might call something like music by market research by the 80s.
Okay.
Now, which is consumerism. Now, I say that myself, but of course I'm part of that whole phenomenon, because I certainly never did musical research, and I've never written a note of music that I wasn't interested in writing, and I've never purposely tried to please anyone else by what I was doing so much as work out my own ideas myself. But I certainly have noticed, like many other composers, that my music has gotten to have, I'm not sure that my next pieces will, incidentally, but that at least these pieces certainly have a very silky surface, that they have a very smooth surface, that they do sound kind of sweet. And the idea for me of writing something that has an underlying complexity, where the technology is very underlying, you know,
all
as
right.
I was saying before, but where this could have the potential to reach a large audience. It's not that the audience was in my mind, but this holistic picture was kind of, I think.
I see. In a way, the holistic character, and also the maybe the influence of 15 years of consumerism, those all have gotten under all of our sort of compositional skins in a way we can't avoid.
Perhaps. But I also have met a lot of people in recent years, and you know, even though they might not be experts in contemporary music, I couldn't help but notice that they were intelligent, sensitive and interesting people. And so I thought, and that part of that perception of the world in general is, I suppose, deep down, is that you don't want to say things that these people will not understand. I'm saying this to you as I think back, because these were not really conscious decisions. These are my own reflections on the music long after I've really worked out the basic ideas of these songs. And as I say, I'm working on some things now that I don't think are quite going to be the same. But it's always a question of what interests me. But in a lot of composers, like Phil Glass's music and many other people, there is a certain audience that is in one's mind. And if you tend to be very humanistic, so to speak, if you're concerned with a very large audience, if you like humanity in general, then you will probably want to write music that they will understand.
It's also sometimes, I think, hard to give up success for experiment.
Give up success for experiment.
Yes. I mean, if you turn away from an existing audience of fans, as it were, a real notion of the word fans in the case of someone like Phil Glass, and try something experimental, your fans may feel betrayed, and it's very seductive to have a very large listenership.
It is. I don't think that I've ever thought of it that way. I mean, for myself, that way, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I've never viewed myself as having fans that I would turn away from or not turn
okay.
away from. In fact, I've specifically noticed in many cases in the past that there is absolutely no way of knowing whether what you do is going to be successful,
uh-huh.
no matter how you think about it.
Aha, uh-huh. Yes, okay.
That
seems to be really an important thing to expand on.
That you can't, you know, there's just no way of knowing. There's no, even with big companies, market research doesn't really work very well. But within the arts, you're not really looking to sell something. I think you're looking ultimately always towards working out an idea. And yes, you might have your ideal audience in the back of your mind, but you're always working out your own ideas. And in fact, I would say that finished pieces are really kind of the remainders of a process. They're sort of like little things that an artist leaves along the way of working out ideas in a long stream of things. And I don't think that anyone that finishes a piece is particularly interested in the piece the moment it's finished.
That's
always,
true.
You're always interested in the next thing.
It's the detritus of the composer's mind.
Exactly.
Mind spoor.
That is exactly right. But I know that that many composers who have tried to please an audience have not, in fact, succeeded. You know, Elliot Carter has told me, actually, he said when he grew up musically, so to speak, during the 30s and the 40s. And he wrote, and during that time, he was writing pieces like Pocahontas and the Pocahontas Suite and some of his earlier works that were part of a general leftist movement in this country towards music for the people. This has happened in Russia. It's happened in many different
mm-hmm,
countries.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea was not to be elitist.
The Neil Kos music group even put out a whole series of tabos called Music of the People
right.
during that era. Yeah.
Okay. And so the idea was not to be elitist. And so Americana themes were chosen, things that Carter and Copeland
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and probably Piston and other and other composers thought of as being accessible to large numbers of people. But as Carter told me at one time, you know, it wasn't successful. That he decided, well, the hell with this. You know, if I'm not going to be successful, I'm just going to go off and do whatever I want to do. And so he went off to Arizona and spent a year and wrote the first string quartet. And he came back, and it was very inaccessible. I'll tell you, this first string quartet was just a major step towards the second one, which I think really defined his
yes.
style.
Yes, Elliot Carter, who we haven't listened to much of on this program, is one of the, I think, particularly a radio audience, is one of the most difficult composers to listen to on a first hearing and make any, not only intellectual sense out of, but acoustic sense out of.
Well, if people are interested in his music, I would certainly say the first thing they should listen to is the second string quartet and listen to it, you know, a few times.
Because I think we'll look it up and play it on the show. The show being the Calvos and Damian New Music Sesquihour on WGDR Plainfield with our guest today, Joel Chatterby.
So Elliot, in any case, you know, he came back from Arizona and he said suddenly he was successful. Suddenly everyone loved the first string quartet. And the bottom line here is that you really just don't know what's going to click. But I think the main point is to work out your own ideas. Otherwise it's going to seem false.
Absolutely true, yes. The no matter what I think, no matter what style you choose or select, if you pursue the audience with the kind of net of your style rather than pursuing the, I would hope the netness of it, you're probably going to end up in the area of false art, in a sense, if that's possible to use it.
I certainly think so. I do think so. Definitely. I think that the arts is something where you cannot do it with market research. You can't do it with focus groups.
Focus groups.
You just gotta do what interests you.
Well, let's wrap this up with some of your detritus along the road here. we're gonna listen to "Many Mornings, Many Moods,"
which is incidentally based on "In a Sentimental Mood" by Duke Ellington.
Yes.
And I'll tell you a little just before
Please,
you play
yes.
that. You know, that was "Many Mornings, Many Moods" was originally written as an orchestral. A concerto for orchestra, solo percussion, and electronics. And it was first performed by the Buffalo Philharmonic with Jan playing solo percussion and loudspeakers scattered
yes.
amongst the orchestral musicians
All right.
throughout the stage. So I wrote that, the entire electronics part, which is the substance of the piece, in a weekend. And one of the nice things about technology and about these programs that I'm working with is that they are so interactive and so easy to work with that this entire piece, which in its first version was about 20 minutes, and its first performance was about 20 minutes, took me a weekend essentially to do, considering that the percussion part was improvised. Whereas if
Mozart,
I'd done this
it's Mozart, 20 minutes in a weekend.
Okay. I won't pursue that too much. But I did design the piece originally. So that it could be performed by full orchestra, small orchestra, solo instruments, or just Jan and myself. You know, there's an expression. Well, in any case, it was the infinitely reducible, reducible piece. And on this disc, it is just Jan and electronics. So that this is the let's say the smallest version of the piece.
Great. Joel Chatterby, our guest today on the Sesquihour, thank you very, very much for joining us. This has been an absolute pleasure, and I wish we had another hour to pursue this. Some very exciting things. Thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Many Mornings, Many Moods, based on After a Sentimental Mood by Joel Chatterby.
Is this the focus group version?
This is the infinitely reduced version, I believe he said. Many Mornings, Many Moods by Joel Chadabee, who was our guest and has headed back to Troy, New York.
After, two more focus groups.
That was after In a Sentimental Mood by Duke Ellington. John Williams on the percussion and Joel Chadabee on electronics. Gosh, he was fun.
He was, and he related a story, a Nadia story.
Yes, one of your favorite characters. We should tell our listeners that Nadia Boulanger, just so that everybody can get in on our private joke here. Nadia Boulanger was the teacher of some of the most famous composers of the 20th century. A great theorist, lived into her 90s, and he told a tale, and it was so delightful to hear his story about Nadia Boulanger.
Just another name dropper while he was studying with Elliot Carter, who we will play again one day.
Yes.
But before that, we have...
Oh, but you were going to tell briefly the story, that he was escorting Nadia Boulanger around.
Yes, but you've already told it even more succinctly than could I. So
yes, and succinctness was exactly the discussion they were having, and he did say that something to the effect of that she did speak to him for about 45 minutes on the necessity to be succinct.
Yes, how lovely.
I liked it. Our quiz, 4547762, will give you another chance. Here it is. Tell us something about this important tune, 4547762. Win two fine prizes. We'll let it go on a little bit. Nope. Oh, no. That's your clue. 4547762.
Glip Sob, preceded by 802. One more time.
One more time. No, there it is. Give us a call. You got another 10 minutes here on Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquire. We have a guest next week by telephone.
Telephonically, Joel Chadabee will be here.
No.
He was here. How soon will we forget?
Yes, we do indeed. Carl Stone. We'll be interviewing Carl Stone. We're going to interview him between 11 and midnight on Wednesday night.
And that's California time, so it'll be very late for us.
And we will, if we are lucky, we'll have that tape edited and ready for you next week on the show. In preparation, we have Walmy Do.
We do?
Walmy Do, one of his many pieces named after Japanese restaurants.
Of course. That's just anything relating to a restaurant on our show is, of course, of primary importance.
Yes, we believe in restaurants and all of that.
And the absence of it here.
You know, when Joel was here, I didn't have a chance to talk about the fact that we had a wonderful lunch together. We had food, and it's always nice to have food.
You did. I missed entirely.
Well, you could have been there, but what were you doing? You were digging out of the flood.
That's true. Flood. Well, let's.
You had ice in the trees.
Lovely, just lovely. When he's talking about going to Europe to perform, and we're trying to dig out of the flood in central Vermont, it's not fair.
I know.
Well, how about that game? The hint of the quiz one more time.
The quiz hint.
Sure. Or just pull up the yes here.
What?
There it is. It's Chet.
Let's listen to Walmy Do by Carl Stone here on the Sesqua Hour, and we'll be back in just a little while. Thank you.
great prize, you know.
This is Paul Douglas speaking, and last week I told you how just
production, a 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 production, a